Hey guys, you know, thank you for tuning in to now officially episode 6 of the Get Out Media podcast. I am your host, James Kincaid, joined by, of course, my dear friends, Billy Newland, and our producer and a dear friend of mine, Spencer Mankin.
That's so sweet.
Like I said in the previous episode, I don't really kayak, so I kind of sat back and let these two pioneers go at it. So this is my chance. My chance is now, and that is land management.
Request denied. Guys.
No, guys, for y'all that obviously y'all heard me talk about it in the intro episode, this is my bread and butter. This is what I am very most passionate about, is taking care of the land and taking care of the natural resources that we have on this planet. Because for y'all that don't know, and for y'all that do, it's really not a renewable resource. We only have X amount of land, and that is it. So, jumping right into what is the definition of land management, and the best definition that I really could find was actually from the National Wildlife Federation, because this one I think kind of hits it on the head. And yes, it does start with wildlife conservation, but it really gets into habitat. And that is, wildlife conservation is a preservation and protection of animals, plants, and their habitats. By conserving wildlife, we're ensuring that the future generations can enjoy our natural world and the incredible species that live within it. To help protect wildlife, it's important to understand how species interact with their ecosystems and how they're affected by the environment and human influences. Because obviously this is a cohabitation on planet Earth. We don't own it. We coexist. So rolling right in, guys, and this is something that Spencer and I kind of were talking about in the beginning before we started hitting the record button, is the resources that are available for you as far as getting into this kind of stuff. If you have a piece of property, you know, whether you're here in Texas or whether you're in Pennsylvania where Billy's at, or whether you're in the West, the East, the South, Florida, anywhere you can potentially have a piece of property to call your own, is reach out to your local state agencies or even federal agencies. One big one for the state of Texas is, of course, our Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. They actually offer a free service to private landowners called the Private Lands and Habitat Program. And essentially, in a nutshell, I actually got it pulled up on the website, is the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department provides a technical assistance to persons desiring to include wildlife management considerations in present or even future land use practices. The service is strictly provided without any charge to cooperating land managers. So managers, owners, this resource is for you guys. So for y'all that, by the time this probably airs, you're probably going to see our first live recording where Spencer and I were actually on my family's pieces of property and going over what the future is of that place. So where do you start is, what are your goals? My biggest thing for me and my family's piece of property is, I am a big hunter. So my goals is all geared around the native game and even the exotic game that live on the piece of property that I have.
Not a big fisherman. Of course,
Billy.
So
what's that?
Not a big fisherman on your property.
Dude, here I am, man. You're hitting a sore topic with Medina Lake right now.
Yeah.
So my family actually owns lakefront property when there is a lake. So could there be fishing opportunities? And as far as fish goes, absolutely. But there's no water right now. I have nothing.
Yeah, you no longer have lakefront property.
Not anymore. Not anymore at all.
What is this lake you speak of?
What is it? It's a dry creek bed now, essentially. And guys, Billy,
just real quick. Is the Medina River bed that runs through the lake, is it dry now?
That is a great question. The last time I was out there, no. So you can actually, like, right when you walk out the north point on our place, mm-hmm. you'll still hit water. But if you go a quarter mile up, it's gone. Like, the river's not even actually flowing. Now, that could change now that with a little bit of showers we've got. But last time I was up there, you can actually get across.
Yeah, we actually didn't go and look at it while we were there that closely.
No, we'll go next time.
Yeah. And it still won't be there.
Right?
Yeah.
But, Billy, I know when you and I first met, you were really big on guiding and actually being a ranch hand and a ranch manager in some cases on numerous pieces of property across East Texas.
Yep. Yep.
So what was like, what was the common thing between everyone that, cause you work for different landowners and you work for different managers. What was kind of like some of the things that you saw as far as what their goals were and what they were more oriented with their pieces of property?
So one of the guys that I worked for, he had, obviously, you know, you'd met him a few times. He had multiple areas of land, some in East Texas, some hill country, you know, Kerrville area. And it really just, it depended on where we were at and what the main species was that I was ranching or managing herds would really kind of be the deciding factor as far as for him, as far as how we were prepping the land, you know, falling trees and, you know, setting up cover and open food plots and stuff. So that one kind of more fell on me. He's just like, hey, you know, I know you're a whitetail hunter. I know you manage and or you hunt for pigs and whatnot. So you kind of know the habitat that they're really around. So when it comes to kind of the more popular free range side of the ranch that we run, that's on you. But as far as the exotics, you know, it's like, okay, for axis and fallow, you know, you need to gear it to where you've got either you've got wide open fields and you've got thick cover, super thick yep. cover. That's it. Obviously with him being in that business and me kind of getting at that point in time, my foot into the door working with those type of exotics, you know, he really lined me out as far as how that went. But then obviously, you know, the other ranch that I managed and worked for, it was mostly pigs and whitetails with a few exotics. So that was kind of the common ground there that we both had experience in. So it was, okay, whitetails, you know, you need all of the above. You need open fields, you need light to medium cover, and then you need that heavy thick cover. So yep. that's kind of how we worked around on all that. And then obviously, you know, hill country area, it's short scrub brush, scrub oaks, stuff like that. So it was essentially with that one there, we kind of had to start on from scratch at, you know, bare bones on that one. So we just kind of, you know, mostly cause it's pretty much whitetail and, audads and stuff that we were running down there. So we would make those big open plots for whitetail and we'd still leave enough thick cover, with the mountain junipers down there. So the whitetail and the audad would have their cover as well. So, I mean, it was just an all across the board thing.
Got you. And hey, I know you said it a couple of times and I'm taking one of Spencer's lines right now, but can you describe what cover is for what you're trying to relate to the people that are listening that don't know?
Thank you.
So cover, essentially, so I'll just keep it plain and simple with the big game animal that 99% of America hunts. That's the whitetail. So open cover. Open cover is essentially just a wide open field, grass. That's it. That's open cover, if you want to classify it as that.
It basically, should be noted real quick. It should be noted that open cover is kind of an oxymoron. I know it's a term that's thrown around, but open cover is actually a lack of cover.
Yep. Yeah.
Which is in and of itself important.
Yeah. So basically you want to hide, lay down. That's it. That's all the more you got. So then you got your like light, medium cover areas where you got a few small sections of like brush, maybe some bushes or some small sapling trees that are kind of in clumps dispersed throughout your field. So it could be kind of like a, I don't know, it'd be temporary day bedding areas essentially for deer. Cause they're not really permanently there. It's more of, oh, I don't, you know, cause you can look at whitetail when you pattern them. Sometimes they just don't want to leave the food. So they'll bed down in these little small pockets of cover. So that's kind of your light, medium cover. Then you got heavy cover, big standing timber, you know, storms come through, they blow top side of the trees. Trees are all over the ground, a bunch of thick heavy, you know, thorn bushes, briar patches, and just yaupon, East Texas, yaupon bushes. They're everywhere. Hill country, yep. It's the scrub brush, the oaks, the little scrub oaks, little cedars, cactus, stuff like that. That thick, heavy cover, that's where they're going to be doing a lot of bedding. So that's kind of essentially the breakdown, so to say, of cover.
So what would you say heavy cover, what kind of visibility are we talking about? How far are you going to be able to see?
At most, maybe 15, 20 yards at most, depending on, you know, what big standing timber has fallen and kind of if it's depressed anything on the ground. But most of the time, if you're lucky, maybe 15 to 20 yard visibility at most.
Yep. And I know Billy actually met both the landowners that you used to work for.
Yeah.
One I want to bring up in particular, if he ever finds this podcast, is Brandon, good friend of ours. Mm-hmm. Is his piece of property, even though he geared it a lot towards recreational hunting with his hogs and exotics, but he also kept it as a working cattle ranch.
Yep.
So he kept a lot of big pastures for grazing and things like that. And Spencer, your family owned a small cattle farm running Brahmas, correct?
Correct. Yep.
So coming from a wild, you know, native game mindset like Billy and I have with the whole hunting thing, mm-hmm. but for going into more of the or ag thing, what were some of the things that you remember doing on that piece of property as far as for ag related?
So for us, it was pretty much we wanted to keep everything wide open so that we could have more native grasses that acts as a food source for the cattle. And so when it came to like timber and things like that, we basically kept large white oaks in that area. We're talking east of Dallas, probably by about 60 miles. So we liked a lot of native grasses. We did keep a few large trees, again, mainly the white oaks, a few pines. And that was mainly just for shade and some protection for the cattle. But yeah, we liked water sources. So we had a few small stock ponds, but mainly it was just native grasses and native forbs and things like that. We had a lot of, in the wintertime especially, we had a lot of cover crops. So we had white and crimson clover. We had some soybeans and things like that as well. But it should be noted that that side of my family, well, I guess none of my family really, there was no hunting on that property. So it was not geared towards, you know, recreational hunting or, you know, trying to bring in whitetail or hogs or anything like that. We did have a lot of hogs on that property for a while, but my cousin was actually a very, very prominent hog hunter. He was actually on TV for a little bit. And so that problem was quickly eradicated.
Nice. I remember that because wasn't he on the Hogzilla stuff?
He was, yeah. And yeah. He's taken some massive, several hundred pound. We're talking 700 pound hogs, which, you know, that's going to be not a true wild boar because, you know, those have bred with native species and farm species and things like that to get that size. Most of your true wild boars aren't going to get that. Well, none of your true wild boars are going to get that big.
No, that's the one thing about feral pigs, especially like you were saying, for the ones actually bred with domestic, you know, domestic swine, mm-hmm. is where they got a lot more of that big size to them. Because typically your average true wild boar, even a big boar, an old boar, is going to get live weight, meaning still got all its inside side of them. Still going to be a 300 to 400 pound pig.
Yeah.
Anything max. Above that, it's definitely crossed.
Yeah. Which is why I like the term feral hog more than wild hogs, because feral hogs will breed. I mean, if they get a chance, they're going to breed with, like you said, the native swine or the farmed or ranched, the ag bred swine. And that's how they get that extra size to them.
Yeah. And we're definitely going to get more into that with the summer coming up with hog hunting. So yeah. We'll dive deep into that for sure. Mm-hmm. But I know the two big conservation practices, and this is coming from the church that I grew up in. We used to always go out to the Bamberger Ranch in Blanco. Big, beautiful 5,000-acre ranch, and anything this gentleman can do for erosion protection, clearing cedar trees to help native grasses grow and things like that. Wanted to kind of bring it back to that soil conservation and what that really is. And for people that don't know, soil conservation is it's a very simple term. It's protecting that top layer of soil, which is typically the most nutrient soil. Mm-hmm. And for y'all that are going to see the live recording of Spencer and I at my family's property, there's not a whole lot of it. It's pretty solid rock.
Yeah.
So one thing that Spencer and I were talking about in this conversation is the only thing we really could do is prevent erosion, because my family's property is up in the high hilltops of the Medina River Basin. So there's natural runoffs everywhere. So it's really hard to keep soil there, because as soon as it rains, it just washes down. So a big thing is starting to put barriers and dams up in those creek bottoms to try to slow things down. But it's been like that for the last several thousand years. So it's not really a whole lot of stuff there. But for you two being out there in Northeast Texas and Billy with your properties in East Texas, that's not really as big of a thing. So
no.
I know the majority of your stuff was hay fields, you know, normal time for the open, as you called it, open cover, yep. Predominantly agriculture hay fields. So besides obviously tilling the land, working the land, things like that, what did y'all do? Because I know there was a couple big rainstorms that came and actually washed out a couple fence lines and things like that. So what did y'all do to try to prevent like washouts from happening?
Man, so that one there was that was just a difficult one to conquer. I mean, we tried, you know, falling trees out and clearing out around from the creek banks, you know, because the one ranch that was there in Nogales, it had that big creek that ran through it. So we cleared out, fell a whole bunch of trees, you know, probably 60 feet away from the bank. And we tried to put in grass to, you know, root in, you know, kind of anchor in that soil. And it worked, but it still, I mean, just the way that creek ran and when the waters hit it, I mean, it just came through like a freight train. I mean, there was that one there. It was just really, there wasn't a lot we could do to really just stop it. But yeah, definitely clear cutting and then adding in, you know, a lot of grass there to kind of root the ground down, and it helped a lot. But I mean, it was still every time something came through, we were out there almost every time redoing it. I mean, it's just the way that creek flowed, it just, there was no stopping it.
Yeah. No, I remember that, man, because that was actually, I believe it or not, I think Spencer, that was the same year in 2015 when Medina Lake filled up overnight. Mm-hmm. We had just gotten so much rain that spring and summer, and there wasn't a whole lot you can do. Because, guys, erosion is going to happen regardless. It's just a natural occurring thing. But there's a lot of things you can do to help prevent it, because keeping that good, healthy topsoil there is going to help, one, keep high nutrient forage for, you know, your deer, cattle, animals, whatever you got living out there. And then not to mention, it's going to provide cover for your the animals that we always overlook, like your snakes, your lizards, your frogs, your mice, things like that. They live in that tall grass. And without it, you know, you essentially get the desert, which barely anything can live out there. Mm-hmm. But another big thing that's especially really important to me right now with our family property is water conservation, because there is none. You know, the lake is gone. The water tables are down. The wells are essentially dry. Like my favorite thing, they're sucking air at the moment. So one thing that I was looking into doing is start doing the cattle troughs and building about every 50 to every 100 acres, putting something there. Nothing crazy. Like I'm not able to do any big like ponds like you see a lot of in East Texas, you know, water retainment ponds.
Yeah.
But something small, couple hundred gallons of water, you know, spread out equally, that way the animals aren't having to travel so far for water. And this one kind of, I know we talked about, we kind of disclosed in our podcast, we're going to say stuff that's controversial and may upset people. I feel like I was that guy a couple of days ago. I was watching some highlights from this gentleman's podcast in the Midwest. He's talking about deer and deer hunting. And he was essentially making fun of people for doing that. He's like, that's retarded. Well, if you ever come down to the desert region of the country, my friend, it's that's probably the only way you're going to make it work. And I know, Spencer, you brought up your retainment ponds for your cattle. Like, what did y'all do? Like, how did y'all set that up? Y'all just dig it with the dozer? Or did y'all actually have to lay down the clay and all that stuff?
Yeah. So in that part of Texas, we had really a sandy loam soil. So super light, super soft. And it didn't have that kind of clay to hold it together. So yes, we dug the ponds. And mind you, this was 50, 60 years ago. So Pawpaw dug the ponds, and then yes, they brought in clay to kind of line it. And then they compact the clay, and that provides a watertight, I'm going to throw up air quotes, watertight seal for the pond, which is pretty common practice, especially in places where you have more of a loose soil structure. So yeah, we dug them out, we brought in clay, and we kind of lined those ponds, and that worked pretty well. We did the same thing when I was living in Granbury. I lived on an old catfish farm, and they had done the same things where they dug it out and they brought in the clay to kind of serve as a liner, if you will, just to kind of hold that water in.
Got you. And how many retainment ponds did your property have?
At our old family farm, we had 33 acres. We had three ponds, probably a total of 15,000 surface feet. Square feet. So they weren't huge, but I mean, on 33 acres, that was definitely plenty. And it was good for, especially in those hot summer days when it was, you know, 110 plus degrees, the cows could get in and really cool off. And so that was very, very beneficial for them. But I mean, they weren't more than probably 6 feet deep at the deepest. So they would kind of dry up because the surface area to volume ratio was pretty low. Anyway, there's a lot of surface area for the depth of the water. So you would get a lot of evaporation, and they would dry out pretty quickly if they didn't have any kind of rain to bring water into those. Mm-hmm. So we did supplement those with some artificial water troughs. You know, we had the big black plastic, 165 gallon. We had a couple of those troughs going, and you know, Pawpaw being Pawpaw, you know, born in the 20s, survived through the Great Depression. He had old bathtubs and things like that out there, just whatever he could get his hands on.
Dude, don't knock it till you try it, because one of our water troughs for our goats was an old bathtub my dad got from a job site. So we definitely did it.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, they work, guys. Hot tip.
Use old bathtubs. Use what you got. Yep.
But no, I've said this several times, but animals need water just as much as us. They're more resilient than we are. We would die very quickly for not having it. But animals are more resilient, but it does help, especially with population health from every species. Having water for them to be able to stay hydrated, stay energized, it's going to keep them healthy and keep them living longer, because predominantly where you start having massive die-offs and animal loss is because of a lack of water. Mm-hmm. But not going to hit this one too hard, guys. Habitat restoration. I know, Billy, you kind of hit on that with replanting native grasses. For me and my family's property is trying to push back that cedar tree line, man. Trying to push that stuff back and let some grass grow, because those things grow faster than the grass. They don't need a whole lot of water, and they can take over a piece of property with a quickness. Mm-hmm. And even the spots that at one point in time within my lifetime were clear, within the last 20 years, they've already been overran again. Mm-hmm. They grow so quick, and they grow tall, they grow fast. And unfortunately, they act like a giant weed. Like, they will suck all the water and all the nutrition out of the soil faster than the grass can even get it. And so that's going to be a big one for me, is pushing that cedar tree line back, exposing more of the oaks, because obviously the oaks provide, they're more hardier tree. Obviously they're native, you know, the cedar trees that we have are actually an invasive species that Spaniards brought in back in the 1500s for fence posts. That's why they're here. And push that back. Not too crazy, because it does provide heavy cover, which, you know, we hit on that earlier, which animals of all species need, because that's what keeps them protected, is that natural cover. An animal in the open, most cases, is a dead animal. So, you know, something's going to, predation's going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why you need to have a balance of cover and, of course, open grazing area. But getting into now what we're all passionate about, the wildlife.
Real quick, James, we will have at least one episode on habitat restoration and sustainable agriculture practices, because I can talk about that for hours. And at the rate that, let's just say modern farming practices are destroying topsoil, I think it's very relevant. And getting back to native plants and native grasses and eliminating the invasive exotic species and non-natives is going to play a huge role in not only wildlife habitat management, but just farming and food production. And it really plays into everything. So yeah, we'll get into that later on for sure.
Oh yeah. No, because I, you know, staying on what you were saying, I know there's a lot of things that go into it. There was a major drought back then, but the Great Dust Bowl, a lot of that was used, happened because the amount of agriculture that was happening at that time. And so it is an ongoing thing with the balance of human needs and, of course, what, you know, wildlife needs. So it's going to be a huge topic point. And we've listened to the Meat Eater podcast, which what's going on up there in Wyoming, I thought was really cool. Spencer, that day we were working, they were talking about the whole elk situation with, you know, farmland and things like that, and how the BLMs are kind of clashing there in eastern Wyoming. So you can tune into them to hear that more about that. But getting into what we're all three really passionate about, and more into the wildlife management, you know, Billy, Spencer, and I, we're all big hunters, love to hunt. But even though we love to hunt, we love to take care of and be stewards of the same animals that we are pursuing every year. For y'all that don't know, if y'all go on all your state, you know, what parks and wildlife pages, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they're going to have documents about endangered species. It's not just going to be about animals. It's going to be plants, birds, fish, things like that. And something that I learned in the county that my family property resides on is that there's 71 different species of endangered species of plants, birds, animals in the county. So being able to assist and guys in preserving some of those species, like one I thought was really cool was the Guadalupe bass, which is, for y'all that haven't caught that little fish, it's a fun, beautiful little fish. But I didn't realize that thing was actually considered endangered in Medina County. I guess because of the fact that there's no river.
Yeah, there's no water, which is where they live. Imagine that.
But no, I know a big thing for Texas is that it's a hit or miss is the exotic species, or what a lot of people call the invasive species. Obviously, feral pigs, not just Texas, but essentially across the entire southern United States. For us, because of the fact that Texans love to introduce non-native species, we all have the Audad sheep, the axis deer, fallow deer, Nilgai antelope in South Texas, New Mexico and Texas share the, share the Gemsbuck oryx.
Just so the people listening can understand what's going on, Billy is sheepishly over there raising his hand, volunteering to get after some of those Nilgai and some of those exotics.
Oh,
there's my all dad sitting on the gun safe right there.
Yeah.
Yeah, real quick, I cut my teeth on exotics. The first animal I ever harvested was an all dad ewe. So I shot an all dad before I ever shot a deer.
And what is a ewe?
A ewe is a female sheep.
There you go.
For y'all that don't know. And it's not Y-O-U. You know, if you ever call your drill instructors that, if you ever join the military, they're going to choke the life out of you. It's E-W-E.
So, here's something that I just recently learned. There is a big game species that in most of the western side of the U.S. and a little bit here in Pennsylvania, and some in this eastern side, but the state of Texas has now classified this big game species as an exotic now. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Elk.
Yes, sir. Elk are now classified as exotics in the state of Texas.
Yep.
You don't need tags.
Nope. You just need money.
Money and a gun.
Yeah. It's crazy how expensive those elk hunts are.
Yeah, but yep. if you're free range National Forest hunting in Texas and an elk strolls by, free game.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. Yep. And for those who don't know, elk are actually native to Texas. They were historically here. Yep. And then they were extirpated by, you know, over hunting and over harvesting throughout mainly the late 1800s into the 1900s. And so they are now classified as an exotic just because there are so few of them, but they are in fact native to Texas. So interesting fact for you there.
Yeah. And not only that, Texas Parks and Wildlife wants to focus more on the ram sheep population. That's another reason why they also classified the elk as an exotic, because everyone really comes to Texas when they want to come to hunt. It's either pigs or they're coming for the sheep, coming for the big rams. And yep. they're focusing more on that than they are the elk. And that's why another reason why they decided to actually label the elk as an exotic.
Mm-hmm. And good luck getting a sheep tag in Texas.
Yeah. Good luck.
Oh yeah. I've been putting in for the draw for the sheep now for 8 years and I'm nowhere close.
Yeah. As a resident. As yeah. a non-resident. Phew, good luck.
And I haven't looked up this anytime recent, but a few years ago I did, because some of the tags for the bighorn sheep in West Texas are actually given to the landowner, and the landowner can do with those tags as he pleases.
Yeah.
There is a company that helps the landowner sell those tags. And the last time I looked at them, those tags are going from $63,000 to $69,000.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got the
governor's tag. I couldn't even fathom that.
Yeah. What's that, Billy?
Yeah, don't forget the governor's tag.
Oh, yeah.
Well, see, the governor's tag in Montana that literally went for $255,000 last year?
Yeah.
Was it last year went for that? $250,000 for a sheep tag.
Yep. That's insane.
But then again, it's the reason why they are so expensive and so sought after is there's not many of them, because mm-hmm. the bighorn sheep just got reintroduced to West Texas within the last 30 years because they went extinct. And I know they used a lot of the rams from Nevada yep. to restock West Texas. So it's definitely a very tough market to hopefully get one of those tags. That's my dream hunt. I would love to go and chase desert bighorn sheep in West Texas. Mostly because I'm a big adrenaline guy. I like hiking, and I just think the hunt in general, the journey would be awesome. Even if I didn't get a sheep, I think it would just be cool to be out there and pursuing them.
So
but that's going to big.
Just for reference, the Wild Sheep Foundation sold the Desert Sheep Permit for Texas, which is a guided hunt on state wildlife management area land, sold January 20th, 2024 at the Sheep Show auction for $145,000. Last year was $175,000, so it's coming down.
A little bit.
Yeah. Maybe one day we'll get everything. Lucky. Maybe one day we'll get it, man.
Yeah.
But no, that just goes right into the topic, guys, is conservation. You know, if it wasn't for landowners and working together with federal and state parks and wildlife, the sheep would have been missing from the West Texas mountains if they didn't intervene and they didn't work together and collaborate on this. So,
yeah, it should be
hats off to all those guys.
Yeah, for sure. It should be pointed out Wild Sheep Foundation is a nonprofit, and that money does go back towards habitat management and trying to promote the reintroduction and what's the word I'm looking for? The improved health and numbers of the sheep, of the wild sheep. I know there's yep. a word for it, but my mind is totally blanking right now.
Yeah, don't get me, man. I didn't pass English.
I barely passed high school. What are you talking about?
But no, to go on and what Spencer was getting at with the Wild Sheep Foundation is also with Texas, there is the TBS, the Texas Bighorn Sheep Society. Mm-hmm. I follow them. I do want to become a lifelong member of them. It's actually one of my goals in life, because all the money that they put together goes towards the and putting in water sources and shelters and things like that on ranches in West Texas, specifically for bighorn sheep. Mm-hmm. So definitely want to get more involved with them. They do their annual dinners and stuff all the time, and I've always wanted to go. I think it'd be really cool to meet everybody that's involved in that. But going back to what we were saying, if it wasn't for those people, we wouldn't have some of the things that we have back in the areas where they once were, you know, from Billy up there in PA with the elk. You know, the elk were hunted to extinction in on the East Coast, and I know Pennsylvania, Kentucky, Tennessee, West Virginia have all essentially reintroduced Rocky Mountain elk to the mountains over there to try to get them back and going. So it's really cool to see. It is. And, you know, for a lot of guys, if y'all ever read any of Daniel Boone's memoirs and when he talks about all the animals that were in the 1800s, like Spencer was saying, because a lot of these animals went extinct in the late 18 to early 1900s. It's really cool to know exactly what was all out there. Like Steve Rinella and Joe Rogan were talking about the reintroductions of jaguars in the United States. And it was a really interesting conversation they were having about it, because the jaguar is my spirit animal. I love those things. But I do know in Texas, because I saw the picture of it, but the last jaguar to be harvested in Texas was just north of Lameda in like 1921. And that was the last known recorded sight of a jaguar. But in like Lewis and Clark's memoirs, they're talking about how there was lions and leopards all over the plains, which they thought they were leopards because of Africa. But it's just crazy to think how much we've impacted, you know, what once was and what it is now.
Yeah. And it should be clarified that we're not talking about African lions here. We are talking about mountain lions, mm-hmm. which are still all over, but they're very hard to find and see unless you're hunting them with dogs.
Oh yeah. And Medina actually classifies Medina County actually classifies a mountain lion as an endangered species in the county.
Really? Wow.
Yep. That's one of the 71 when I looked it up.
About 3 years ago, I was hunting in San Saba at a buddy of mine's property, and I was out just kind of walking around. I wasn't really hunting. I was just kind of looking around. We were on our new property, and I had circled back to where I had started kind of my little walkabout, and there were mountain lion tracks where I had just walked. Like literally, I had a boot print, and then there was a mountain lion track on top of it that obviously wasn't there before. So I was kind of being stalked by a mountain lion, and man, you want to talk about something that'll give you the heebie-jeebies. Goodness. That was, cause it's a lot like your place where it's just thick cover. It's just brush everywhere. So you can't see more than 50 feet. And if you got a mountain lion that close to you, that's creepy, eerie. Still making the hair stand up on the back of my neck.
Yeah. And that ranch that I managed and got it on in Kerrville, we have one, well, had. It's been 10 years ago since, you know, I was last down there, but there was one that was living down there in Kerrville, and we seen it a couple of times and seen the tracks quite often. There was a couple of caves on that ranch, and it was used in those caves to sleep in and stuff. And, mm-hmm. you know, we've came across a, you know, whitetail that it had killed, or a hog that it would kill, you know, hidden up and whatnot. But we seen one out there and seen the tracks multiple times. I mean, there's mountain lions in Texas. It's just, you got to be at the right place at the right time in the right area.
Yeah. It should be noted that I'm not going to say exactly how old I am. Yeah. I'm 36 years old. I've been in the outdoors in Texas pretty much all my life. I've never seen one in the wild.
Really?
Yep. Hmm. But if you are in Texas, especially Central Texas, and you want to see some cool mountain lions, the Austin Zoo actually has several of them. And that zoo is actually a rescue facility. So they have a lot of rescued animals, and it's worth going and seeing. It's not your typical zoo. It's more of like it's much smaller and much more, should I say, intimate. They've mm-hmm. got a lot of peacocks and turkeys and, you know, game animals like that walking around. It's a really cool little zoo, but I mean, I wouldn't go in there expecting like the San Diego Zoo where it's got all these crazy exhibits. It's much more of a small town zoo, but it is a cool little place. And they have, last time I was there, like 5 or 6 mountain lions in a big enclosure. And they're just a cool animal to see up close.
No, one, if y'all ever find yourself in the San Antonio areas, check out the Animal World and Snake Farm Zoo in New Braunfels. And they have 2 mountain lions. They have a pair of jaguars, both a melanistic or the black one, the black panther, and a normal phase, white lions, hyenas, and they're all close. Like, you're not looking at them from a distance. And
they have hyenas they'll do there?
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
And they'll do shows where they feed them through the fence up front with you, where you can actually, like, see the lion, like, right in front of you. They'll make it stand up to get the meat, and you're like, holy, yep, I'm going to die if the thing ever grabbed me.
Yep.
It's just game over. But then again, I am the one that spooned with a Bengal tiger in Thailand, so maybe I'm asking for it.
You're also the guy that goes out and catches random snakes in the wild, so...
Hey, man, Tejano Dundee over here.
Yeah, right. What'd you catch the other day? What was that?
So that was actually last night. And while driving home from my buddy's house in Seguin, Texas, not Seguin, everybody, Seguin.
Seguin.
I caught a Great Plains rat snake. And for y'all that go to your pet shops and see corn snakes, it's a subspecies, subvariant of that one. So really cool. I had one as a pet when I was a kid, and that was the first one I've ever seen in the wild. And I was just driving down the road, and it was crossing it, and I whipped a U-turn, sprinted back over and grabbed it, freaked out some people in the neighborhood, but hey.
Yeah, it should be noted, you didn't like catch this thing in like a plastic tub or something. You just reached down and grabbed it.
Oh, yeah. I still got the scab marks where the sucker bit me a couple of times.
Yeah. Again, let wildlife be wild unless you are educated and trained.
Yep. But hey, it needs to be noted that the snake wasn't harmed. I did get it across the road into a field and I let it go. So it's back out there.
There you go.
And one I really want to post up, because we're talking about the endangered species, the Texas indigo snake. A few years ago, both of y'all actually heard all about that one. That one was cool. And the photo of me with my arm down in the hole to grab it.
Dude, okay, so for people who are listening, this dude literally, it was out at your property, and there's holes and caves and all this weird stuff. You know, there's scorpions and spiders and all kinds of poisonous stuff hiding in these holes. And James sends me these pictures, and he's literally like shoulder deep. His arm is like all the way down in this random hole in the rock. And the next picture is him pulling out this indigo snake out of the hole. And I'm just like, nope, there's no way I'm doing that. Not enough money in the world. Nuh-uh. Nope.
Dude, I freaked out when I saw it, because the Texas indigo snake is my favorite snake, you know, on planet Earth. It's my favorite.
And why is and that?
Two things. One, just the natural beauty of a Texas indigo. If y'all ever see an indigo snake in person, the translucent, like, it's insane. It's black, but it's not. It's, they got hint of blues and purples, and as it moves, the sun refracts, whatever the technical term is, rainbow back at you. Like, it is insane. I know Billy's seen them. They are absolutely stunning. And secondly, dude, they're like the same reason why the king cobra is called the king cobra. They're the king of the snakes. Like, this thing eats rattlesnakes. It eats everything. Like, nothing besides birds prey on this thing. It's the king of the reptile world in Texas. So
where can people go to find these pictures?
So I will make sure that I'll put them on the Instagram for you. But if you want to see them immediately, you can go to my personal page on Instagram, james.kincaid.09, or you can actually go to Billy's page, Final Moment Outdoors. Scroll back a little bit. You know, there's been a lot of posts since then. And you'll see me with the Texas indigo, which I definitely let it back in the same hole that I found it. So if any Texan Parks and Wildlife people are listening, I put it back, I promise.
Yeah, so James, you've been to my dad's place. And you know, right when you walk out the front door, we got that, you know, nice little East Texas Pebble Creek ramp goes up into the garage. We have a drain pipe that runs under that little ramp. And there was a blue indigo that lived in that drain pipe right under the ramp going into the garage. lived there mm-hmm. for years.
Dude, it's what I think is really cool about the Texas Indigo. It is literally common knowledge and across all landowners across the state. That's the only
shaking his head. No.
Yeah. That's I'm only not, snake.
No, leave me out of it.
But that's the only snake that they won't kill. And you'll see it all the time, man. I see people on like hunting pages, things like that. They'll post up a picture of a snake they killed. They're like, hey guys, was this a rattlesnake or was this a copperhead? And it's sad because 9 times out of 10, it was not even a venomous snake to begin with. Mm-hmm. You know, just the senseless fear and killing of reptiles because you're afraid of just one particular one is crazy. And
that's me.
Funny story. Yeah.
I just leave them alone. Yeah.
Well, funny story about the rattlesnake and the fear of rattlesnakes. I've never actually ran into a rattlesnake on our family property. Now, are they there? 1,000%. I have never found one, and I actually go looking for them. Like, I want to get some awesome photos of a rattlesnake on my family's property. You know, you always see the cool rattlesnake in the blue bonnets or rattlesnake, you know, in the deer head and all that stuff with the wildlife photographers do. Like, I would love to capture that shot. But my real experience with rattlesnakes actually came from my buddy Matt's old property, which regrettably, you know, it got sold here recently. Sad note on that. But it was summertime of, I think it was June of 2009, and we were hawk hunting one morning. We got out there super early because everyone knows summertime in Texas is just stifling hot. And we had just tried to climb into his little deer stand, and it was ransacked by field mice. They were just everywhere. And he was just like, no, I'm not doing this. We'll just go keep walking. We'll go check a couple of the water holes and see if we can catch pigs down in the mud. Well, we're sitting there walking, and we hear this noise, and we stop. We're on the road, so there's nothing around us. It's just open field and this road we're walking on. And we stop because we heard something. And then out of the corner of my eye, like directly down at my feet, I see movement, and I look down, and there's like this 2.5 foot Western Diamondback, not coiled up, not anything, just slithering across the road. It literally goes over my boot. And the first thing Matt does, which y'all heard Matt, he's the typical Boomhauer redneck. He literally jumps about 5 feet back, cocks his 30-30 lever action, and points it at the snake. And I was like, dude, don't you dare. My foot's right there. Like, he was immediately about to blast this thing. And I actually convinced him not to kill the snake. We let it slither off into the cedar tree line. But that was my first real encounter with the rattlesnake. You know, luckily it didn't bite me. But, man, I was more afraid of Matt in that 30-30 than I was that snake.
Mm-hmm. So it's funny you got that snake story, because I got one that my mom's going to kill me because I know she listens to the podcast. So, couple different terminologies, you know, in the East Texas area. Puff adder, hog nose. Either which way you want to swing it. Anyway, so basically, a hog nose, one of the two things it'll do in a defense situation, A, it'll play dead, or B, it'll puff out and it's going to look like King Cobra. So, mom's out working around our driveway. And James knows this. We have a big circle drive at the house. And she's over. She must have been moving flyers or something. I don't remember what she was moving. But she jumps back. She hooping and hollering and running back towards the house. Get the gun. It's a cobra. There's a cobra over there. Go over, turn to find out it was just one of them hog nose that got pissed off and puffed up like a cobra. And she's freaking out. Dude, I was dying the whole time. Like I picked the thing up, and you know, I was handling it. Dad comes home like, hey Dad, you want to see my new King Cobra? Like, it was funny. Like, I don't know. It was one of the funniest things I'd seen. Mm. So at least I didn't have a 30-30 pointed at my feet.
There you go.
Right.
So we've talked a little bit about cover and natives versus non-natives and human wildlife conflict management. We'll call it that.
Yeah.
So what about population management when it comes to managing your land or your property? What are some things to consider there?
First thing that I really like to do is knowing what I have on the piece of property. And I know we typically take about, I'll definitely get into that. Now, my biggest tool that I use is my trail cams. And obviously when I get out there, I can document stuff with my own eyes if I see it, but the trail cameras really do help because they can be there when you can't, they can be up at hours that you won't. And it helps out a ton. And I currently have three up and going. I had a fourth one, but unfortunately it is no longer up. I got to get another one. But I have about a camera for every 100 acres that are out there at my grandmother's place. And what I'm looking for is, it's hard to tell with does. It's easier to tell with bucks, especially when they are going through the growing season and obviously hard antlered. Is trying to identify individuals. So try to get the most accurate count that I can get as far as how many deer are frequenting the property. Because the property, they don't just stay on your property. You'll have deer travel miles and they'll go to neighboring properties, and you have deer during the rut come from neighboring properties onto yours. It's just trying to get an idea of one, how many do I have in total, just overall numbers. And then the more importantly to me, how many do I have that are actually mature? And what I mean by that, how many are actually older, you know, healthier? How many fawns did I see during the spring and the summer? To how many fawns did I see in the fall? Because unfortunately, right now, one thing I want to know is predation. How many predators do I have frequent in the property? Because my cameras have caught numerous bobcats on camera, numerous coyotes, numerous gray foxes, and unfortunately, stray dogs. You know, dogs can become feral and go wild to people. So pets have gotten out and are running through the property. We had a huge issue with that 2 seasons ago, where it was like every day I go out there and I find someone's dog on our place. And just essentially just keeping track of what's out there, what's moving. And of course, we have our exotics, which we talked a little bit about on the live episode, from the oddads and the few axis deer that frequent the property. So just understanding what's out there. And then of course, do I need to harvest any? Do I need to let more go this season? So I really look at it from the hunting perspective is, am I going to overpressure the property or I'm going to let the property rest? And I use the trail cameras come in clutch when it comes to me helping me and aiding me. And, you know, the guys that I have involved in the management side, like, you know, you, Spencer, on what we're going to do for this upcoming season. So I try to keep the cameras going year round because it's not just during hunt season. You know, I want to know fawn yields and things like that. I want to know if the predators are bad. But another thing I really like to capture with my trail cameras is, you know, for people where it's all private land, is obviously we got trespassers, and we've had a couple of issues with people being on the property that shouldn't have been on the property.
Well, people and wildlife, or I guess,
yeah,
not wildlife, the cattle. But yeah. Yeah. Farm raised animals that aren't supposed to be right there.
Yeah. That decided to turn my camera setup into a scratching post, and I got 3 months worth of sunset photos. Mm-hmm. It wasn't capturing anything that was actually at the feeder. It was pointing up to the sky. Yep. But Billy, I know a lot of the places that you guided on were not just low fence, but some of them were actually high fenced. Yep. But even on the high fences, y'all used a lot of trail cameras because some of those properties were 600, you know, almost upwards of 1,000 acres.
Yeah, absolutely. We used a lot of trail cams. There was also, you know, multiple daily rides around the fence lines, because Brandon's ranch, and you know, you've been out there, mm-hmm. coyotes were a big thing and they would dig under the fence. So, you know, to kind of mitigate that, you know, we were running trail cams and, you know, we would do our daily rides around the fencing, and we would find those, you know, dig unders, and we would set traps there, snares, footholds, mm-hmm. or whatever. And that's one big way we would mitigate a lot of the predators getting in. And we didn't catch every one of them. You know, I shot some that were inside the fence. But that was just a big thing. And the other high fence I worked on, the smaller one, we actually had electric fencing running the bottom around that. Yep. So that, I honestly, the only thing that I ever seen inside that was a red fox inside the fence there. Never seen any coyotes inside that one. And I worked that one. That was the longest one I worked. And I probably worked that one for 5 years managing that place. Mm-hmm. But that electric fence was definitely a lifesaver as far as keeping predators out.
So what are some things to consider when you are, say you go and buy a trail cam? What are some of the things to consider when placing that trail cam? What are some of the things you're looking for?
So the one thing I'm going to look for is I like to look for trails that are running north and south. I don't like setting my camera facing east or west, because if you set it facing east in the mornings, let's be honest, that's when a lot of your big mature deer are going to bed. And if you're setting your camera that's on a east facing trail, you're not going to see what's coming in there in the mornings to come into bed, because that deer is not going to take the same route going out every night. Obviously he's not going to take the same route coming into the bedding area. But I like to face my cameras north and south on any game trails. But as far as picking a camera these days, man, it's six one half a dozen or the other, because they're all good. They're all, everyone's really nowadays going to those cell cams too. So it's,
explain those real quick.
So cell cams, I'm going to just use Cuttyback here, because I know a lot of people who run these Cuttyback cell cams. So basically what it is they run essentially off of a cell tower. They got an antenna. You get them hooked in and connected to a network, you know, by use of your cellular device. And you can set it to send pictures every 6 hours or however, whatever duration you want it to send that X amount of photos it takes. Or you can set it to, it takes, when it takes a photo, it instantly sends it to your phone. But those are a lot of what I'm seeing these days. And they have different, you can select different, I guess you would compare it to a cell phone plan, where you can get X amount of pictures, or you can get pictures and videos, or you can get, you know, let's say 500 pictures this month plus 20 videos, or you, whatever. I mean, it's unlimited. I wouldn't say unlimited, but you've got options to what you want that camera to do.
And it should be noted that the cell cameras, you pay a monthly service fee for that cell service.
Yeah. Yep.
Which, yeah, James, what are you paying for yours? I don't know what that runs.
I pay $34 a month for four cameras, and I get unlimited photos and uploads.
There you go.
And I use Stealth. So all my cellular cameras are from Stealth. And one thing I really want to emphasize on, Billy, about the whole why you don't want to face your camera east to west. Because, guys, sun rises in the east and the sun sets in the west. If you want to see nothing but blaring, glaring photos, put your camera facing east or put your camera facing west.
Yep.
And if you actually, I know this sounds crazy, people, if you read the owner's manual, it would even tell you to put your camera on the south side of whatever your feeder, your trail, field, whatever you're trying to capture, to the south, because in the northern hemisphere, the sun, even if you have it facing north, facing south, when the sun pushes, when the earth tilts on its axis in the wintertime, that sun is actually going to drop in the horizon in the southern direction. So you can still wind up having blared out photos from the sun. So you always, in the northern hemisphere, you want to have it south facing north. Southern hemisphere, you want to have it north facing south, to eliminate you having nothing but sun glared photos, and you're actually seeing what's coming.
Yep.
One big thing that I really look for when setting up my camera, right now I have them all on bait stations, because in Texas we can do that. So I have them all facing a feeder, whether it be a protein feeder, because I do have a protein feeder up there running protein. And of course my just broadcast feeders with a mix of, typically it's a mix of deer corn and protein, but right now we're just running deer corn because stuff's getting really expensive. We're like $12 a bag just for deer corn and almost $20 a bag for protein. And so I have predominantly like set up on that. Now, when I haven't had it on a feeder, I typically want to find areas that I don't want to push, constantly have to go in and do a lot of human interference. So sneak in deep into some heavy timber, find a really heavily used trail gate, because you can see it. You can go in there and see where there's just frequent animal tracks and stuff's moving in and out of. Just sneak in there that one time, set up that camera facing that trailhead, and then getting out of there. Because you'd be surprised how much stays in the cover and never comes out to the open.
Yeah.
So food sources, commonly used trails. I think water sources is another good one, especially if you're on a place like James's where water's
scarce.
Yeah. places where animals are going to frequent are going to be the best places to set up your cameras.
Yeah. One thing I think water source, in my opinion, is absolutely the best. And the reason why I say that is because even though you will see gray foxes, and it cracks everyone up that always sees this, gray foxes will eat deer corn. So it's crazy when you see a gray fox at a feeder with your white tail and they're eating together. But what I really love about putting a camera on a water source is you'll capture the predators, because obviously coyotes and bobcats and all the different other animals, they all have to drink. So you get some of the coolest things on camera at a water source that you typically wouldn't get just on a food source.
Birds, squirrels, everything's got to have water.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yep. And I love capturing like owls and hawks, man. They bring out some really cool shows at a water source. There was a good friend of mine, his grandmother owned a small little 20 acre track. So, yeah.
1 hour. So,
there we go. A small little 20 acre track. And he put a camera on their water source that typically was used for their cattle. But man, he caught some amazing photos of owls and red-tailed hawks like at the water, man. It was super cool that you wouldn't see at a deer feeder.
Yeah.
You know, so I think water sources, especially if you're trying to get an idea of what you have out there, I think water sources, in my personal opinion, would probably be the best place to put a camera.
Especially again, if you don't have a lot of water on your property. So what are some laws and policies and regulations that should be considered when you're talking about land management?
That's a good one, man. Personally, I'm still reading up on all the laws. So what my recommendation for people that are just now getting into it is obviously just do a quick Google research of your local legislation on this. Because yes, even though it is privately owned property, the state still has a say of what you can and can't do. One big thing, blocking a waterway. You know, we're talking with Luke. You cannot do that. You do not own the waterway that goes through your property. So definitely read up into that, especially if you want us to try to put, you know, dams and things like that, because you may be violating some local legislation in regards to that. Also, the state, it sounds bad saying this, but the state does own the wildlife on your piece of property. So besides like your exotic animals, which the state doesn't have any regulations on, you can't just go and do whatever you want with, you know, the white-tailed deer or quail or javelina. They're still governed by the state. So make sure you're working within the law, even on your private piece of property.
Yeah. It should be stated that while they do regulate, quote unquote, regulate, they have regulations on these animals. Sometimes the regulations are, hey, you can pretty much do, like with wild hogs, hey, you can pretty much do whatever you want. I mean, you don't, at this point in Texas, you don't even have to have a hunting license to hunt wild pigs. You do still have to have your hunter's education. So go ahead and knock that out. And you can do that online, you know, in an evening. But yeah, just because there are regulations on it doesn't mean that you can't do it. So just read your local laws and regulations on that. And again, quick Google search can tell you a lot.
But also on that, Spencer, when he said you can pretty much, you can't pretty much. You literally can do whatever you want with feral pigs in Texas.
Yeah,
you can. You can. You think of a creative way to hunt hogs, I don't think the state's going to pay no mind to it.
Yeah. I mean, you can blow them up with explosives. You can hunt them from a helicopter and, you know, operate a door gun And I mean, there's just, you could do pretty much whatever with the wild pigs. But when it comes to exotics like the elk and the javelina, I don't think there's a ton of regulations. In fact, I don't want to say anything exactly just because I'm not super up to date on that. But yeah, just check your local regulations. A lot of times it's going to say that, yeah, there aren't a ton of regulations.
Yeah, well, with the javelina, because I know you just mentioned that, and for clarification, because I'm very well aware of the javelinas because I have them on my place, you're only allowed to harvest two javelina for the entire hunting season, and that is from August 31st or September 1st of whatever year you're on to August 31st of the following year. So for 12 months, you're only allowed two per person, two per license holder.
There you go.
Now, feral pigs, rack them and stack them. You can do whatever you want with those. And make sure you know the difference between a feral pig and, as Billy loves to say it, he needs to trademark this, jalapeno pigs, aka the javelina.
You cannot take jalapeno pig. I'm actually working on trademarking that, by the way. So it's, the process has started. Jalapeno pig, that's mine. No touchy.
And fun fact, jalapeno pigs or javelinas aren't actually pigs.
Nope.
What are they, Billy?
Oh, hold on. You asking me scientific stuff now. You're going to have to.
Come on, James. What are they?
They're a collared peccary.
They are a peccary. Yes.
Yep. Or if you really want to get all creepy in the science, they're apparently a direct descendant of a rat, which I don't care what they say about that. Yeah. Looks like a pig, smells like a pig, acts like a pig. Scientists, it's a pig.
With some jalapeno in it.
Hey, jalapeno. But no, guys, I think we're getting pretty much close to that, getting wrapped up here. Really just want to hit on this. If you're new to this, if you want to get into this, you're a future landowner. Definitely. We harp on this every stinking episode. Do your research. Mm-hmm. Talk to your state agencies. Talk to people who are already landowners or someone who's a land manager of sorts, like Billy was. Billy did not necessarily own the land, but he was given custodial rights of sorts to take care of it, manage it, things like that. Get with those people. They'll be able to help you and point you in the right direction for your small piece of property. And guys, it's really fun. If you're any form of nature loving, whether it be like even farming, gardening, all that stuff, you really will enjoy getting involved in land management and wildlife management. It is really cool, really exciting. A lot of information out there, a lot of how-to videos.
Yeah, it should be noted that land management doesn't just apply to hunting. I mean, we're talking, like you said, ranching, farming, or just general property ownership. I mean, it's a good idea to bring in the native plants and restore the habitat to what it's supposed to be, and not this, you know, piece of property that's full of non-natives and, you know, things that the wildlife aren't supposed to be eating and aren't developed and designed to eat, because they haven't had that for the last 1,000 years. So don't bring in a bunch of non-natives thinking, oh yeah, well, it's a good food source. Well, maybe not necessarily. So do your research. There's tons of information out there, and it's going to be different for every location. So I encourage people to just get out there, do a little bit of research, learn something, and just try to make the world a better place.
Yep. Exactly. And yes, even for you guys out there in the lower 48, as far as the Rocky States, even though it is BLM and public land, you still have a responsibility to that land. You know, whether how you leave it, like we talked about in camping, taking care of it while you're there, while you're utilizing that, the ability to access that property, it goes hand in hand. You don't have to be a private land owner to practice wildlife conservation and land management. You can literally be doing it on someone else's pieces of property.
Yep. Well, there it is.
Yeah.
Land management 101. I'm sure we will have follow-up episodes to this because we can all kind of talk about this for quite a while. But I think that's kind of a good starting point for us. So, as we always ask on pretty much every episode, what's coming up in y'all's world?
Well, the kayak build is about to be wrapped up.
Hey.
The final things are on the way.
Nice.
And it's going to be a lot of fishing. I actually had a podcaster reach out the other day, and I've met this gentleman before, and his son is getting into kayak fishing, and he's trying to figure out a local lake here, so I'm going to be taking them out and showing them the ropes on this lake and kind of getting them more versed in kayak fishing. So there's going to be a lot of that coming up in my world.
Nice. James?
For this guy, try not to melt in the summer that's about to smack us here in Tejas.
Oh, man. It's already rough.
It is. No, I think it's going to be an ongoing thing for us down here, is obviously as we continue to want to provide the best content for you guys as you're listening, get more and more into the filming that we've been talking about, Spencer. I know we haven't really harped too much on it, but Spencer and I are really big into photography and filmography, and we want to capture as much as we can in the things that we do and get it to you guys. So focusing a lot of that here in the future, and then, of course, continue to work on my family's piece of property, getting it ready for this coming season. And obviously coming up in the summer, we're going to start hunting some hogs. That's what's coming up for us here in Texas right now.
There you go. For me, it is still my garden, which has unfortunately kind of been neglected and beaten down with all the rain. But I've got plenty of green beans coming in. My tomatoes are finally looking good. My cucumbers are starting to come in, looking healthy. So hopefully this weekend, you know, I've been slammed with work the past couple of weeks, but I'm hoping to get some time this weekend to get out there and kind of maintain that garden and try to grow some food.
Heck yeah.
There you go.
Yep. All right, gentlemen. Well, thanks for coming. And we will see. Well, I guess we won't see everybody next week, but we will talk to everybody next week.
So make sure you tune in to Get Out.
Thank you. Beautiful.
Oh, yeah.